This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Nathaniel Mackey is a poet, critic, editor, and novelist who has won some of literature's most prestigious awards for his work. They include a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Book Award, and most recently Yale University's Bollingen Prize. A common thread in Mackey's writing is his passion for music, and his most recent book of poetry is Blue Faza. Nathaniel Mackey joins us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me here.
Tell us, Blue Faza, tell us about the title, where it comes from. I think that would give us good insight into how you write.
Well, I'm very much a fan of jazz and world music, and it's a title that brings together those two things. Blue Bossa is the title of a piece written by trumpeter Kenny Dorham going back to the early 1960s, and it's become like a classic, a hard bop piece, and you can go in, it's in every fake book, and if you, you know, go into lounges and things like that, it, you know, every beginner learns Blue Bossa. The Fassa are a group of Soninke-speaking people in West Africa, and there is an epic song poem called the Dowsy that that they sing, and it has to do with the lost kingdom, the lost empire of Ghana, not the modern Ghana, but the ancient Ghana, going back to 14th century, that kind of thing. And I brought those two things together. Blue Fassa obviously rhymes with Blue Bossa, and I was making a connection, Africa and African America, you know, bridging that diasporic, you know, leap or movement across the Atlantic.
And just to give us a sample of some of those rhythms you were hearing in your head as you put that together, we do have Joe Henderson's version of the jazz classic, Blue Bossa. Tiny bit of Joe Henderson's performance of Blue Bossa, an inspiration for my guest Nathaniel Mackey's book of poetry, Blue Faza. You know, I think of poets in many ways as interpreters, people who bring things together and can interpret. And the idea that jazz is in many ways an interpretation to some extent of an African-American experience here, and then you go back to sort of an ancient civilization on the continent and kind of pull those things together. As you write, are you conscious of those things at that intellectual level, or how do they come together in your mind as a creator?
Well, I'm conscious of them. I think that, you know, part of being a writer is being very conscious, hyper-conscious even. But there's a part of the creative process that is subconscious. And to keep those two elements in conversation, even when you can't hear all of the conversation, is one of the jobs of poets and of sculptors and of musicians.
I wonder if I could get a sample of some of your work right now. Would you read a little bit of Moment's Gnosis for us?
Okay. Momentary release, the most they'd gotten. Liberatory, this or that, debated endlessly. Philosophic posse's pet. How to make moment more than moment, they kept asking. How to make moment not elapse. Moment shall abide was everyone's gambit. Moments more than momentary life. Moment's gnosis, everyone clamored. Moment's gnosis. Though moment's gnosis meant each moment has its way. Thus they'd have had it both ways, philosophic beginners. Soon come concordance, ours for the asking, the we whose adherence they claimed. Philosophic pinch, philosophic phosphor. Not to know moment or no sooner know than not. Moments knowing nothing if not vanquishment. Relinquishment, they called it instead. As if instead we stood around in circles, hunched over, heavily exhaling, let go. Moment more the less could be made of it. We grimaced, arms out, had at by bliss, misgiving. More than any one feeling, flew. Fleet release, nothing if not momentary. Flew, but fleet release fell back.
My guest is Nathaniel Mackey. His latest volume of poetry is Blue Fossa. That is a section of a poem called Moments Gnosis. What I deeply love about your work is the way it works very, very much as sort of intellectual, philosophical tract, and then the words themselves dissolve. And so all of the mechanical function of a word dissolves into a beautiful kind of aesthetic. It's a sound, it's a rhythm, and all those things work together at once. So your brain is popping on all cylinders if you read it closely.
Yeah, I strive for that. And one of the things about poetry and literature generally is that you can reread it. And so the two sites of reception are important in my conception of what poetry can do. I want it to have that immediate impact even on a first reading, the kind of thing that you talk about just now. But I also want it to be something that one can go back and read and reread and continue to pull things out from. I don't think that everything can be gotten on one hearing or even one reading. But I think that there's something visceral that is gotten on a first hearing or a first reading. And hopefully that leads a reader or a listener to go back, linger with the poem.
Then do you write and rewrite and rewrite and rework your poems?
Yes. I spend a lot of time making very minute decisions. One of the things that it's hard to remember when talking about the poetry of a musical poet, and I consider myself a musical poet, is that music also works semantically, and semantics works musically. We are most aware of that when we learn a foreign language, and we don't have the accent of a native speaker. Mm. And essentially what we don't have is we don't have the music of the language. And often that actually gets in the way of native speakers understanding what we're saying. So there's a tendency to separate sound and sense. And there's a tendency to separate music and meaning. But I think the two go together. And one of the things that I'm very attentive to in writing is not just the sound, but nuances and, you know, gradations and shadings of meaning. I mean, words can mean roughly the same thing, but not exactly. I mean, the word form and the word shape can be thought of as synonymous, but there are shades of difference between the word form and the word shape. And when you write, you have to make a decision. Are you going to use the word form, mm-hmm. or are you going to use the word shape? And you have to take into account the various dynamics that adhere to one word that don't adhere to another.
I would think also, and tell me how you feel about this, that it's not only the valences in that, the definitions of that word, but also its place in the sentence, the kind of rhythm it's going to give the whole sentence, and the feel I'll get if I put that word here at the end of the sentence, given the number of syllables, so that the sound and rhythm are dynamic. There's no vocabulary or definition for the sound or the word, but when I put them together, now I've got myself.
Yeah. Syntax.
Yeah.
Position. What goes where? Yeah. What comes next? What went before? Do you write a sentence that reads back on itself, or do you, you know, supply everything in a linear way?
You do a lot of that, especially in these poems, these kinds of reflexive use of a word where it shows up in one sentence meaning one thing and then maybe the first word in the next sentence and suddenly the valence shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sort of speak that way? Does that happen to you, or do you have to work a lot to get that effect?
Over the years, I've come to speak that way more and more. I mean, I am a professor, so I do a lot of extemporaneous speaking in classrooms and lecture situations, and I found that the way I speak and the way I write are a lot closer now after years and years than they were at the beginning. It's the imprint of my style, you know, that has been developing for, you know, years and years now.
You won a National Book Award in 2006 for your collection called Splay Anthem. How does winning an award like that, or does it, affect your career and maybe the way you look at your work? Does it have an impact?
Yes, it does. I mean, it's, you know, we all write in a bunker. You know, we write and, you know, we're our own audience, first off. I mean, you know, you're the first reader of your work. And you don't always know, you know, who your audience is, or indeed early on whether you have an audience at all. So an award like that affirms that you do have an audience, that you have readers, and that you've been given, you know, a very considered kind of reader reading. And so it's very important and rewarding to get that kind of endorsement.
Then do you feel a kind of pressure to keep living up to that, whatever that means, or that phrase means?
A little bit. A little bit. I keep writing, and I have a newer work, usually, than the work that has been given an award. So I don't feel that pressure so much, because I've moved on to newer work, and I usually feel pretty good about that newer work.
Would you read some of your newest, or at least in your latest volume, Blue Faza, another poem, or a section of a poem?
Let me see if I can find one.
My guest is Nathaniel Mackey, who's teaching at Duke University and whose latest volume of poetry is called Blue Faza.
Yeah, here's one. It's called Old Time Ending. Reluctant light lights evasion, faces lit. Solon, one of them called it. They sat around the fire. Reticulate eye light. Life outliving childhood. Bottomless whimsy, bottom line, wisp. All atop time running out, what the attendant buzz was. Gleam seen somewhere else, anyone else's eye. All to say they lay thrown out of the car, sprawled at cliff's edge. Their heads hit the dirt, they saw stars. It seemed they saw love's low claw, rims riding asphalt, rode their distended redoubt. Saw themselves thrown from the car, remembering when. Skin's old regard, more skin. The end of it met the end of the world. Skid no out of which but out, dead or passed out. Unseen outside face, they fell inside.
Nathaniel Mackey reading from his latest volume of poetry, Blue Faza. He's teaching at Duke University, teaches creative writing at Duke, and is an accomplished poet. We talked about your attachment to music. You were a DJ, college radio guy, just like me. The two of us were together, except you've won more awards. But which came first for you? Was it music for you, or poetry, or were they both always part of your
life?
It
was writing for me. Yeah. That goes back to when I was a very young kid, even before I knew how to write, before school. I was intrigued and fascinated by this thing that older people did called writing. And my mom reminded me when she was still alive that I would, you know, imitate writing. I would pretend to be writing. I'd get out a pencil or something, and I'd scribble on a piece of paper. Writing made an impression on me very early, and music was not very far behind.
Though. Being impressed with what older people do, of course, is a good thing, but thank goodness for you, your parents wrote and didn't drink and smoke, because it would have been an entirely different story. I heard an interviewer ask, he had Toni Morrison and Frank McCourt on his show, and asked them both did they think, in a way, that they were writing in a foreign language? Frank McCourt of Angela Ashes, and of course Toni Morrison, in the sense that they were part of a diaspora who is now speaking a language that had been given to them.
I think that keeping the foreignness of language a forefront in one's mind is important for any writer, even if one is speaking or writing in a language that is one's native language, you know, without some kind of diasporic displacement or something. I think that writers are attuned to the weirdness of language, the everyday uses of language that tend to familiarize it to us and make it less than the magical kind of unbelievable thing that it is. I think that writers are more sensitive to the fact that this is a curious thing that we do. And I think that's a large part of what a poet named David Anton I once heard say was getting at when he said that there's no such thing as a native language. We don't come out of the womb speaking a language. We are taught the language that we speak, and it's called native, but we have to learn it.
It's great stuff, Nathaniel Mackey. What a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Nathaniel Mackey is Reynolds Price Professor of Creative Writing at Duke University. His new volume of poetry is called Blue Faza, and you can find out more about the book and Nathaniel Mackey at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski is on the board today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.